reading from, Stones of Atlantis, Dr. David Zink. We followed his on-site inspections. Two of them. The analyzing of the rocks and the underground formations off Paradise Point in Bimini. And I don't really want to review tonight. You think I should have to?
No, sir.
Well said. All summer, one question was uppermost in our minds. What was the original function of the Bimini Road? Would we find anything relating to a sacred site? Because they had come to conclude that those underground formations of stones were man-made and that they represented a megalithic site, just as Stonehenge. Mystery Hill in New Hampshire. And others scattered around this world. And among other criteria for identifying a megalithic site is they serve a sacred function. So the question is asked, would we find anything relating the Bimini Road to a sacred site? True, as our work continued, the evidences of man-made patterns in the huge blocks continued to accumulate, and the same evidence also seemed to favor the presence of a megalithic site. But then one day, while diving on the Paradise Point site, I observed a strange grouping of three stones. I had passed over them dozens of times without noticing the pattern, and now wondered how I could have missed it. The three stones formed an arrow configuration, and when related to the nearby base of the chalk stone, I'm not reviewing. You just got to figure out for yourself what the chalk stone is. When related to the nearby base of the chalk stone, the group, that is the three stones forming an arrow configuration, seemed to point towards the east. Encouraged by this hint of order in the ruins, I swam northeast up the main lead where, to my surprise, I observed two long, thin, nearly cylindrical stones at approximately the same distance as between the arrow and the chalk stone. They looked very much like obelisks or standing stones, although now, like all of the stones on the site, they were resting in a horizontal position. Because they tapered to one end and rested on several smaller stones, it is conceivable that they once stood in a vertical position. It seemed unlikely that this geometric layout oriented to the equinox was an accident of nature. Now, I've skipped over a couple of chapters to this point in the book, where he records some of the difficulties and hardships they had in pursuing this line of endeavor to see if these stones could provide any substantial link to the theories of Atlantis, and if not, were they in and of their own at least megalithic and man-made in nature? Well, you won't find your average bank downtown willing to finance such a project. Neither will you find private investors like those that will fund the salvaging of a sunken galleon. Who is going to give an English professor at a college specializing in Victorian literature money to fund all this undersea exploration? Really, when you're pursuing a myth anyway. Now, tune in on it. Because as I read this on-site detailed inspection work, and we have skipped beyond where we left off last night, the very expensive work of taking core samples of the material in the joints, core samples of the rocks themselves, and then comparing it with all the beach stones in and around Bimini, we're talking about a lot of expense with no hope of a oil gusher to pay off the capitalization. And since there is no profit that is the goal of the exploration, you can't even attract people to invest in it as a tax shelter. You see, a naive person might say, well, if there was anything to this, it would have been explored and someone would have found it out. Who? You want to get a snorkel and spend the money and buy a boat and do it next week? We're not talking about Stonehenge or the pyramid that you can conduct guided group tours to. That's why they have laid there underwater for so many centuries. And someone would fly over and say, oh, look, strange formation of rocks. Now more clues begin to fall into place. All that speech was to say, this is quite a project this English professor engaged in. And he, I don't blame him for taking a few chapters to whine a little. One chapter's entitled Bugs and Barracudas. Now more clues begin to fall into place. I recall that the number 5 had been found to be emphasized in 2 places. In one portion of the site, we found an extensive line of 14 single stones about 4.5 feet square, which gave way to a pavement-like section 5 stones wide, each of them about 8 feet by 11.5 feet. This very impressive area ran over 105 feet to the northeast. Here is a diagram and a drawing. Remember, he was very pleased that they had an artist along with him. Here's a drawing of the arrow stones. And here's a drawing of the 14 stone, 5 stone pattern. And then these are drawings of the geometric layouts, the angles involved, and the arrow stone. He says more in the text. In another section, which John Parks, the geologist that was along with him, felt was highly evidential of man's intervention, 5 large stones were found side by side with 5 small ones, changing to a pattern of 6 pairs of stones equal in size. This stressing of the numbers 5 and 6 in the layout brought to mind John Mitchell's, the expert on megalithic sites, connection of these numbers, 5 and 6, with known megalithic sites. Late in the summer, John Steele led a party that discovered another possible megalithic link. They found fragments of huge stones indicating that the shorter arm of the J could have once extended a considerable distance. This suggests that the original design could have been shaped like a horseshoe, as with the trilithons and the bluestone horseshoe of Stonehenge, a feature also found at Stonehenge. The arrival of an unexpected visitor soon revealed that only a few hundred yards west of the road lay another possible clue to man's early presence. Jacques Mayol, a diving expert and a friend of Dr. Valentine's, wanted us to see a puzzling trench close to the road site, which he and Dr. Valentine had come across in 1970. When John Parks joined us for a close inspection of the trench, he concluded that it was not a natural fault in the seabed. No fractures were in evidence at the corners of the flat-bottom trench, which seemed to have been cut out of a solid limestone of the seafloor. For many weeks, we worked on the geological problem and the site survey, finally coming to the last week of the expedition this particular year. In the tropical heat of late summer in the islands, everyone was tired. On the 7th of August, we were all checking out a new pattern in the blocks when suddenly, 20 feet below, I spotted what appeared to be a man-made shape. Diving down, I found on closer inspection that the stone object was definitely man-made. Only about 6 inches of one edge was exposed, and the minimal marine life on this part suggested that the current had only uncovered it very recently. Within minutes, I got the others over to have a look, then photographed it before raising what proved to be an ancient building block. Despite the gathering thunderstorm overhead, we were jubilant as we saw that it had a very sophisticated tongue and groove pattern and was a fragment of a larger piece. With careful measurements, we determined that its flat sides were not parallel, and that its varying thickness of about 3 inches suggested a sloping wall or molded brick. And we hoped that it might have been fired and thus datable by available scientific methods. The chert and limestone elements evident in its composition indicated a sandstone and limestone mixture not found in the Bahamas. Nothing definite could be said about it until we could date it and, if possible, assign it to a known culture pattern. Could it be a relic from the site of another ancient culture? To skip down to their second find, here we found a style, skipping over in the diving, etc. Here we found a stylized head, which we estimated at 200 to 300 pounds. It seemed more like an animal head than a humanoid one, particularly from its left side. Rolling it over, I knocked a small chip from a bottom corner. When we surfaced, the chip proved to be a beautiful white marble. No marble is native to the Bahamas, and this chip had been eroded at least an eighth of an inch by the destructive processes of the sea. Recognizing the significance of this find, I realized that to raise it, we would have to get special permission from the government. Had I known the trouble it would later entail to obtain, I would have gambled on the political hassle of raising it there and then. Thus, they had found, by the end of the season, two man-made artifacts. Here's a picture of the building block with the groove to fit into the tongue, reminiscent of the lintel stones at Stonehenge. Thus ended that season. Back in Virginia, the author of this book came to a crossroads. Not an exit on the Virginia Turnpike, but a career crossroads. Was he to continue his university teaching or continue with this energy draining and financially draining research, knowing that a winter was going to come and go while he wrestled with the decision? He began to dig into the library side of it on Plato's theory. Much of Plato's legend is obviously beyond verification today. The quote, legend of Atlantis. Yet as I thought about it, I realized that some aspects were more susceptible to investigation than others. For example, among the trees and abundant fruits which Plato described on the land were those yielding, quote, drinks, meats, and ointments, end quote. Other sources have reinforced my conclusion that he was referring here to the coconut, which is not native to the Mediterranean and was unknown to the Greeks until about a century after Plato's time. Continuing on with Plato's story, and we read it to you the other night, I found reference to a particularly important factor, the location of Atlantis. In the Timaeus, Croesus says that that voyagers going west from Atlantis had access to the islands, and from the latter to the opposite continent, which is located at the edge of the real ocean. How could Plato, supposedly ignorant of the existence of the Americas and the Pacific, write with this geographical awareness? Now, the answer may lie with the ancient Piri Reis chart, compiled by a Turkish admiral around 1513, 20 years after Columbus' first attempt to reach America. Amazingly, it shows South America and may also reveal outlines of land under the Antarctic ice. Now, here is that map. See the coast of Africa with the elephant on it? See North America. See South America. Follow my cigar. Connected to Antarctica, which has been under ice allegedly for 20,000 years. Yet this map shows it as accessible landmass connected to South America. Since the coast of Antarctica has been covered with ice for 20,000 years, one can well ask how this information, only recently confirmed during the 1957-58 International Geophysical Year, was known more than 450 years ago. Namely, at one time Antarctica was not under ice. Charles H. Hapgood, cartographer and historian, was asked to examine the Piri Reis map. After careful study, he and his students concluded that it was based on a Mercator projection, listen close, taken from the intersection of the meridian of Alexandria, Egypt, and the Tropic of Cancer, most probably the meridian of the pyramid. You don't want me to continue? I'm reading from The Stones of Atlantis by Dr. David Zink, who did on-location explorations of the strange stone formations underwater off Bimini. college professor, English, Victorian literature specialist, now on the verge of dedicating his life to trying to solve the puzzle of the strange underwater stones off Bimini. Even granted, he says, that the legend of Atlantis has always intrigued the human imagination, I was amazed to find that the topic has been treated by some 5,000 works or books in 20 languages. It's almost like the Bible. Try as the skeptics may, they can't stamp out human interest in it. In the last few years alone, interest has grown to an incredible degree. Modern Atlantean theorists are the latest in a long line of such thinkers who, in Aristotle's case, for example, go back to Plato's own era. In the past century, over a dozen major theories of Atlantis have surfaced. Many of these are nationalistic in thrust, locating Atlantis in the writer's own part of the world. But as I reviewed their work, I found that all these theorists fall into one of three distinct groups. One, those who believe that Plato contrived the legend himself, or he was a liar. The earliest skeptic of Plato's account was his own former student, Aristotle, who himself wrote of an island in the Atlantic known to the Carthaginians as Antilia. In reference to Plato's Atlantis, he quipped, quote, "He who invented it also destroyed it," end quote. Well, it's nice to tell a story about a nation that disappears. People, mountains, land, everything. The latest and best-known skeptic is L. Sprague de Camp, whose book, Lost Continents, maintains that Atlantis is merely a literary theme Plato devised to continue the moralizing of his republic. So much for the skeptics. Second group of theorists. Those who would edit Plato, either by moving the site of Atlantis out of the Atlantic, or by dividing his measurements by a factor of 10 or what have you. This group is represented by writers like Velikovsky and by the Greek seismologist Galanopoulos, who claimed in 1960 that he had found Atlantis on Tyra in the Aegean. He convinced the Reader's Digest. Third group. Finally, those who thought that Plato was giving an honest account of events that may really have happened. Sounds like my analysis of the resurrection of Christ. In the course of my researches, I began to find myself supporting this latter group, those who believe him, which has as its pioneer spokesman Ignatius Donnelly, or Donnelly, who was one of America's most learned congressmen. The last 70 years of the 1800s is when he lived. And once again, we find that strange coincidence of an explosion of knowledge in that century, particularly about the middle of it. Everyone interested in Atlantis should read Ignatius Donnelly's work. Why did I put this message here? Oh. Is there a bus coming from Buena Park on Sundays? Answer is yes. All the buses are running on Sunday. Get on them. It's a holiday weekend. Best excuse I can think of for coming to King's House 1. You can play on Monday. What's that? Isn't it? My people don't stay away on holiday weekends and ruin my holiday. After years of work in the Library of Congress, too bad we don't have more congressmen like him. They spend time in libraries. After years of work in the Library of Congress, he published his book, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, in 1882. I feel this work initiated our modern study of the Atlantis question and outlined the major problems for future research and investigation, and I agree with him. Donnelly's work had the same effect as Davidson's work on the pyramid and Hawkins' work on Stonehenge. Others have taken it and gone further, as Tom did with the work of Hawkins, and Rutherford did with the work of Davidson. But Donnelly brought America's attention in the 19th century to Atlantis. Donnelly built on the work of earlier writers who considered the Azores and the Canary Islands to be the remnants of Atlantis, and others who had argued that the Mayas were descendants of the Atlanteans. During the ongoing rediscovery of the Mayan culture in Mexico's Yucatan, in British Honduras, now Belize, Honduras, San Salvador, and in Guatemala, many have commented on the strong architectural parallels between the Mayan and the Egyptian culture. Step pyramids, columns, obelisks, stelae, or upright slabs of stones with inscription or sculpturing, the use of hieroglyphics as ornamentation, bas reliefs, and a strange absence of the true arch. Both cultures had the corbelled arch, as did ancient Mycenaean Greece. In addition to the architectural parallels, Donnelly found significant similarities between Egypt and Central and South America. Early use of the solar calendar, sun worship, mummification, and pyramids. Donnelly believed that Atlantis represented the first civilization on this planet, that it was the center from which these characteristics were diffused, that its far-reaching colonies extended from the Atlantic base to as far as Central Asia, and that its destruction was historically factual. He set forth his position in 13 propositions. One, there once existed in the Atlantic Ocean, opposite the mouth of the Mediterranean Sea, a large island which was the remnant of an Atlantic continent and known to the ancient world as Atlantis. Two, the description of this island given to Plato is not, as has been long supposed, fable, but verifiable history. Three, Atlantis was the region where man first rose from a state of barbarism to civilization. Four, it, Atlantis, became, in the course of ages, a populous and mighty nation from whose overflowings the shores of the Gulf of Mexico, the Mississippi River, the Amazon, the Pacific coast of South America, the Mediterranean, the west coast of Europe and Africa, the Baltic, the Black Sea, and the Caspian were populated by civilized nations. Five. Atlantis was the true antediluvian world, the center of it. The Garden of Eden, the Garden of Hesperides, where the Atlantides lived on the river ocean in the west, the Elysian Fields, situated by Homer to the west of the earth, the Gardens of Alcinous, or Alcinous, grandson of Poseidon and son of Nausithous, king of the Phaeacians, of the island of Sharia. Atlantis was the Neompolis, or navel of the earth, a name given to the temple at Delphi, which was situated in the crater of an extinct volcano. Atlantis was the Mount Olympus of the Greeks, the Asgard of the Eddas, the focus of the tradition of the ancient nations, representing a universal memory in all races. Gotta sneeze. Representing a universal memory power. Representing a universal memory of a great land where early mankind dwelt for ages in peace and happiness. 6. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
The gods and goddesses of the ancient Greeks, the Phoenicians, the Hindus, and the Scandinavians were simply the kings, queens, and heroes of Atlantis. And the acts attributed to them in mythology, a confused recollection of real historical events. 7. The mythologies of Egypt and Peru represented the original religion of Atlantis, which was sun worship. Now, there's where Donnelly probably gets the furthest off, assuming that the original religion of Atlantis was sun worship. The original, if Eden was there, the original worship was of God. But a competitor was there too. And when sons of God mated with the daughters of men and came to dominate with their misrule, then sun worship replaced the original worship. Well, let's go on. 8. The oldest colony formed by the Atlanteans was probably in Egypt. The first place outside Atlantis on this earth where an Atlantean colony was formed was Egypt. And probably that colony led by Enoch, although he didn't say that. 9. The implements of the Bronze Age of Europe were derived from Atlantis, and the Atlanteans were also the first manufacturers of iron. 10. The Phoenician alphabet, parent of all the European alphabets, was derived from an Atlantis alphabet, which was also conveyed from Atlantis to the Mayas of Central America. 11. Atlantis was the original seat of the Aryan or Indo-European family of nations, as well as of the Semitic people and possibly also of the Turanian races. 12. If his theories are true, it was the seat of all races. And this may bother some lily-white fundamentalists in the South, but there is much more evidence that the mark of Cain was being made white than what some fundamentalists preached, being made black. 'Noah,' as the old Celtic cauldron shows, maybe the most ancient archaeological relic, was mongoloid, and his wife was the white matriarch, a descendant of Cain. I don't lock up your refrigerator for the rest of the night. 12. Atlantis perished in a terrible convulsion of nature in which the whole island was submerged by the ocean with nearly all of its inhabitants. 13. A few persons escaped in ships and on rafts and carried to the nations east and west the tidings of the appalling catastrophe which has survived to our time in the flood and deluge legends of the different nations of the old and new worlds. Now that raises the very interesting idea that some may have survived the flood other than the, to quote the Apostle Peter, 8 souls who were in the ark. Interesting. But before you abandon the Apostle Peter's view that only 8 souls survived the flood and the ark, wait until I get back to the origin of the nations in that book by that Baptist teacher on God endowing Noah and his sons and their wives to repopulate the earth. And since they were descendants of original Atlanteans, they could be, though that isn't what Donnelly meant, a few persons escaping on a ship who then carried to the nations east and west the tidings of the appalling catastrophe which has survived to our own time and the flood and deluge legends of the different nations of the old and new worlds. But that edits a bit Donnelly's 13th proposition. Too hot in here, Mike. The nearly universal incidents of flood stories around the world and widely distributed legends of destructions by fire and water provided the background for Donnelly's theorizing, as they later would for Velikovsky. The Mayas and the Aztecs, for example, tell of 4 destructions. Other cultures speak of as many as 7. Donnelly was probably the first to focus upon the peculiarities of the Basque people of the Spanish Pyrenees, whose language cannot be related with certainty to any other language or group of languages. And later, this author says, what anyone who researches will find, there are other Atlantean theorists, other references to this area of the Spanish Pyrenees and the Basque people as an Atlantean colony. Now, many anthropologists would now condemn Donnelly as an extreme diffusionist, all theory and no facts. They would explain the similarity of cultural traits as part of the psychic unity of mankind, a concept originally formulated by Adolf Bastian. According to this theory, similar environmental and cultural conditions tend to produce similar human responses and similar solutions to common problems. Thus, parallel developments in widely separated cultures might be expected to occur independently and be discovered only when communications were finally established between the cultures in question. Like so many theories, 10 times harder to believe than Plato. Let us assume, for example, that 2 Stone Age cultures, innocent of the engineering principle of the true arch, needed openings in their stone walls. They might devise the post and lintel doorway. But they could choose another approach by piling the stones up in a wall, gradually moving the stones of each new row toward the center of the opening, all without outside influence, thus would achieve what is now called the corbelled arch. Those who favor independent invention would explain by this process the similarity of other transatlantic cultural traits, and on the theory goes, stranger than Plato. But for the record, it should be noted that diffusionism is alive and well in a recent book by linguist and historian Cyrus H. Gordon. And it is Cyrus H. Gordon who first traced the commonality between the Hellenic culture in its great age in Greece and the Israelites in Palestine, and proved, I think, beyond refutation, that the great cultures of Greece, starting with their city-states, were not aboriginal, native to Greece cultures, but rather the culture grew up through the influence of movement from Egypt to Greece, as Israel moved from Egypt to Palestine. And the Israelites and the city-states of Greece, it is Cyrus Gordon who first provided the basis for showing the common root in the Israel and Hellenic culture being Egypt. Easy to explain when we understand that the second wave of foreign rulers to go into Egypt were the sons of Jacob, the shepherd kings who furthered and continued to exercise the power of Joseph, who was absolute ruler over Egypt when they came down there. But when a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph in Upper Egypt rose up and drove him out some 50 to 100 years before Moses' birth, the ruling class, the descendants of Judah through Zara in that case, fled by sea to form the city-states in Greece, Athens, and the other great city-states, and also to form Troy. And then they began to fight with each other, just like the Israelites did when they got to Palestine. The non-rulers of the Israelites were made slaves to be led out on an exodus by land by Moses some 40 to 100 years, Moses being born after the throw out of the shepherd kings, and then some 80 years after his birth, Moses leads him out.
This is the end of side one. Thank you.